The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Hope you had a good week. We'll see what happens next week. Lots of crazy things going on out there. Every day, new things and things of great concern. This has been planned, this whole episode in our history, in human history, in planetary history, has been planned to an extraordinary degree. And the diabolical nature of it is shocking. Let's just put it that way. It's quite amazing. Okay, tonight we're going to do something fun with Admiral Cooper. We're going to walk through his new book, Lost World War II U-Boat Photographs. Now, this is unusual. He has so many photos, and he could probably put out 10 books like this, maybe more. Harry, are you there? What do you mean, mm-hmm?
You caught me with a mouthful of coffee there.
Oh, I thought it was Entenmann's or spaghetti and meatballs or something exciting.
No, no, not at this hour. Nope. No, I just listened to your monologue and having my coffee and thinking, well, that sounds like a fun show.
Well, you ought to listen in.
I try.
How many photos do you think you have?
It's over 280,000.
Well, and you literally went through a good number of them to pull the photos for this book. How many pictures in the book?
There's over 300. I haven't counted them, but there's over 300. We're doing it in the number of U-boats. In other words, this volume, which is the first one, is just now coming out, is from U-1. To U-130, I think it is. So, no, 134. So this is volume one, and we're going in U-boat order. Now, with some of the boats, there just plain are no photographs at all to be had anywhere, period. Others, for instance, U-108, we've got about 60 or 70. Not only the boat, but also the crew, how they're going about, and you'll see some of them tonight. And there are also some photos of ships they've sunk and combat action they're in. But also, you know, we're so used to seeing U-boat photos with the U-boat on the high seas in combat or something like that. Well, here we see that too, but also the normal day-to-day life, the guys peeling potatoes, The radio man cutting the skipper's hair. Very informal on the submarines. Not like, the big ships where everything is spit and polish. So it's pictures of some of the crewmen celebrating Christmas at the shore. So it's we've even got one of a submarine. The photos taken of the submarine through the porthole of a freighter that they stopped to search in the early days when they did the prize regulation stuff, and before the print got before the photo got printed in the magazine, Life magazine, the submarine was already sunk. So, and in the early stages, which we'll see a couple of them here, in the early stages of the war before the U.S. got into it, they treated the German forces the same as the British and the French forces, etc., because they were just combatants in another war. But once the U.S. got into it, suddenly they became Nazis and baby killers and all that stuff. The propaganda machine got cranking.
Right. It's amazing what war does to, it's the old axiom. The first casualty of war is?
Truth.
That's it. It's gone.
Yeah.
Gone.
Yeah, and you know, we've discussed this many, many times. You have to kill the truth during a war. As I've said, you cannot tell your soldiers, the guys on the other side of the battlefield in the other uniforms, they love their country like you love yours. They got a wife and children they want to get home to, just like you want to get home to your wife and kids. They go to the same church you go to. Now go kill them. People would say, wait a minute, let's rethink this, you know. And you can't have a war there if you don't hate the enemy. But my hard feeling is that once the war is over, you got to make the history correct. Kill the propaganda, kill the lies, kill the baloney, and be truthful, which is what we do at Shark Hunters, and have we paid a price for it?
Oh, I know. I used to think you were a pretty square guy until I
watched you read what the SPLC said.
Oh, yeah. I always check in with the SPLC every Monday to find out who I'm allowed to talk to and who I should, associate with. And just, it's a fact check, right? It's a fact check.
The idiot Marxist editor of our local mullet wrapper newspaper has blocked my email. I can't send letters to the editor anymore because he read on the Southern Poverty Law Center's website that I'm a Nazi, which is absolutely false. And the Shark Hunters is a hate group, even though Ronald Reagan was a member, the four Medal of Honor winning skippers, and thousands of American veterans, many, many British and some Russian veterans still members. So maybe if I had given them a donation.
Why do you have that big swastika tattooed on your chest? I mean, let's be honest here.
Well, that would surprise me because I don't have any tattoos at all. Oh. When I was in tech school a million years ago at Lowry Air Force Base, Denver, and I knew I was going into Strategic Air Command, me and several of my buddies went out in Denver, and I was going to get the SAC emblem tattooed on my right shoulder, the big iron fist with the lightning bolts coming out of it. We couldn't find a damn tattoo parlor. There's tattoo parlors everywhere. We couldn't find one. So I've never gotten a tattoo.
That's Jack Daniels' fault.
Yeah. No, I didn't drink in those days. I never started drinking until, I was through the Air Force, through college, and I was into the working world. And it was only when I started driving race cars professionally that I started drinking, because that was part of the
right
image.
Before every race, that's the only time to do it.
No, after the race, especially short track, and all the drivers would be standing in line by the pay window,
right?
And the crews would be running around, and I'd hand my crew chief some money and say, "Get me." I always drank VO and seven, And get a drink for Doheny over there, because I shoved him into the wall. And get another one for Taylor, because I bent his A-frame up, and he can't drive for another week. You know, everybody's friends and buying each other drinks. I got to where I liked all that booze.
That was kind of a fraternal club. That's what people... They don't do that much anymore, I guess. Maybe they do. I just don't see any.
I don't see it anymore either. The big corporations, they got half a dozen cars or so. I remember one race where we were doing time trials up at the Milwaukee Mile, and the differential, the rear end, or as we call it, the pumpkin, something went wrong in my car, and I didn't have a spare. Another guy there, Bay Darnell, loaned me a rear end, and we only had a short time before qualifying closed. And the PA announcer was doing a play-by-play, watching my guys take the old one out, put the new one in, and we got done within like 5 minutes before they closed time trials. Uh-huh. And I ran the best time I ever did there at Milwaukee, and I was running really well until I was drafting on Bobby Unser lap after lap, and I knew Bobby, and I know he's looking in his mirror wondering how the hell is Cooper going like this, you know. And he and I
what was
were
it,
coming
was
through.
Was it the rear end? Wait a minute. Hold on. Was it the
pumpkin?
No,
it was a different
difference?
Gear ratio, too. So my engine was running a lot higher RPMs. But anyhow, we were coming through turns one and two at Milwaukee, and we were passing a slower car. I can see it now. I close my eyes and see it. Johnny Reimer's number 93, a yellow Camaro, and we were passing him, and I guess he thought he could run with us, and he got on the gas a little too early, lost his side bite, his rear end come out and clipped my nose and put me into the wall at 140 miles an hour, and that was the end of my day.
The end of your car, too.
It was mostly skin damage, and that was a Thursday race, and we worked on it without hardly any sleeping at all, and we came back by Sunday and ran the Sunday race.
See, that's amazing how you can put something back together like that with duct tape and spray paint.
100-mile-an-hour tape, that's what we call it.
Wow.
That was a lot of fun, and like you say, it's a clannish group. Everybody knows everybody, and it was a great time. I don't know if it's
big business now.
Big money. Unfortunately, that's the case. Yeah, some of these guys, I don't know if this is fact, but I've heard it from too many sources. But guys like Jeff Gordon and Kyle Busch and all these guys, they're getting paid $20 million a year salary. We got the money we got in the prize money. You know, if you come up with $1,000, okay, that was your money. And the tires, they were $150 a piece back in those days. I don't know what they are now, but you go through maybe 20 tires in a race, times 150 each. Gasoline was free. But you had to have a truck and all your equipment, and my crew was all volunteer, but I had to feed them, and I had to get them from point A to point B and put them up in hotels. And all that cost money, but damn, it was fun. It was so much fun.
Now, that's it. You're running on just for our listeners, a mental picture. You're running on a paved oval.
Yeah. The High Bank Super Speedways. Milwaukee was the smallest track we ran. That's a mile. We ran Texas World Speedway and also Michigan International Speedway. Those were two-mile tracks, High Bank. And we ran Pocono, which was a 2.5-mile tri-oval. It only had three corners. It's a weird track.
A three-cornered? How interesting.
Yeah, none of the straightaways were equidistant. The front chute was like a mile long. Then from one to two was a certain amount, and then from two to three was not quite as much as one to two. But we were getting over 200 miles an hour way back then on the front chute.
Wow!
Damn, that was fun.
When I was a kid, they had. In Southern California, they had races on TV, on KTLA, Channel 5. And they had an announcer named Dick Lane, and he would do everything from roller derby to dirt track racing, and it would all be on TV. And, mm-hmm. and one of the drivers, when he always had a funny way of pronouncing this guy's name, kind of a fun name, Parnelli Jones.
Yeah, Parnelli Jones. Him and AJ had one hell of a war going on all the time. A nice war, but I mean they competed.
Yeah. Well, that was fun. And then roller derby. You remember roller derby?
Sure.
It's kind of like
the first thing I ever watched on my folks' TV. I was 10 years old, and my dad came home from work, and they sent my sister and I upstairs to our room, and we wondered what we did wrong. And then they called us back downstairs, and my dad had bought a TV set, black and white, with this rabbit ear antenna. I was 10 years old. That was in 1949, and that's what was playing. It was the roller derby. Incidentally, you mentioned Parnelli Jones. His name really is Rufus Parnell Jones.
Yeah. Well, fun times, and then whatever. Black and white TV, rabbit ears. Yeah, I've seen those. I've seen them in antique shops. They still have them around. Yeah, they'll pick up some local stations and things.
I've got one. It's a beauty. It's a huge, big Motorola in a Drexel cabinet made in 1960 that I got when one of our members died, the Reverend Dr. Orrin Potito, head of the National Christians, which was another way of saying neo-Nazis.
I know.
He was an engineer, and he designed a lot of the automatons that are at Disney World.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, good times. Great, great inventive, creative Americans. They had so many more back then in those mm-hmm. days. Now, what do people do?
They write a lot.
Creativity. They just watch. They stare. They react. They fear. They live in fear now in this country. They hate the government. They're afraid of cops. They're afraid. They ought to be afraid of politicians. But they live in fear. It's the truth.
Yeah, I know. When I was a kid, I was taught, if you ever had trouble, go to the local beat cop. I grew up in Chicago, and we had a beat cop. He walked around. He had 4 or 5 square blocks, whatever, and he walked.
Right.
And everybody
right.
knew the beat cop. And if you had any problems, you ran to the cop. I was like 4 or 5 years old, and I knew
world.
If I had trouble, go to see the officer.
Now the last thing you want to do is involve the police, unless you absolutely
In some areas. That's not
where you are.
Yeah,
but
where
yeah,
I'm
I mean,
at.
Seriously, you get in a combat zone, which is otherwise known as an inner city, a big city.
Oh yeah,
like Lizard Lightfoot's Chicago. You know that little cretin will not talk to or give interviews to white journalists anymore. Only black.
Yeah, I know
that's
been all over the news, and I got friends in Chicago. And they keep sending us stuff. And she was supposed to have an interview with a Hispanic news guy, and he said, hell no, he canceled the interview. He said, that ain't fair.
See, no, that's right. It's just racism. There's no other name for it.
In reverse, and it's all designed to divide the country, put this against that. And, you know, here in Shark Hunters, anybody can be a member. We got black members. We got Jewish members. We got white. We got Hispanic. We got every kind of member. And they're all just fun people.
I know.
Keep it out of the, you know, forget politics. Leave that to the professional liars.
The professional liars paid for by all of our tax dollars.
Right.
And they get as much money, of course, as they can steal when they get up to the big time, and that's why they want to get up to the big time. They
remember
steal
what Harry Truman said, you show me somebody who gets rich in politics, and I'll show you a crook.
Oh, yeah, and they all get rich.
He bought his own postage stamps when he was president. He licked his own postage stamps, and when he got out of office, he got in his own personal car and drove back to Independence, Missouri, all by himself without a police escort. And they just showed something on TV. Kamala Harris went to, where the hell was it? Some major city. 40-car caravan. Uh-huh. Not one damn soul came out to wave for her. There were a handful of people with protest signs, but that was it.
No, no, no. What's going on here is blatantly obvious to
virtually
everyone.
Yeah, the destruction of the U.S.
That's right. They pulled the plug on it, and the country is now destined for the ash heap of history. They'll keep it around in some form or another. We don't know yet exactly what or how many will be allowed to survive, but we know now that 160 million Americans have gotten at least one shot. 148 million have gotten both shots. Now they're talking about their semi-annual booster and so forth. And all the research that has been done by very brave, independent scientists and doctors who are literally risking their lives speaking out about this.
That's
and it,
true.
It tragically looks like a lot of the people who have taken the shot are not going to be around for a whole lot longer. They're going to have a shorter life than they planned on.
Yeah, I have no way of knowing since I'm not a scientist. But
we're just guessing, but the guesses all point to that very thing. You can't turn the human body into a genetic
factor. And some of the so-called scientists like Dr. Fenucci there. Fenucci, if you remember, The Godfather 2. Anyhow, Tony Fenucci, you know, one day he says, do this. One day he says, no, don't do that. The next day he says, do something else. The guy has no credibility. He's a little weasel, and he's got the CDC going around in circles. Nobody believes anything anymore.
Well, that's a very good summation. And we're talking about Americans who still think, but nobody who has a mind who can think in a linear fashion believes much of anything anymore. Not from the government, not from the entertainment industry, if they're smart.
Yeah.
It's bad. The education system is completely communized now, unless you're homeschooling, and that's it.
Yeah.
Hold on just a minute, Harry. We've got to take
Roger
a break.
That.
We'll come right back.
I'm going to play solitaire.
Okay, welcome back. Talking with Admiral Cooper. We're going to do a little bit on his new book now. The new book, Lost World War II U-Boat Photos. And what he's doing, this is going to be a series. He started with U-Boat U-1. I didn't know there was a U-1.
You got to start from somewhere. And one is the
Well, that's
place
what
to
they
start.
Say. Well, okay. Now, this is World War II.
Yeah.
Not World War I.
Right, they started the numbers all over again. They had in World War I, they started with U-1,
mm-hmm.
and then they had the UB and the UC series, et cetera, in World War I. But after World War I, and Germany had no more military, and then when they started rebuilding in the 30s, they started with U-1, which, strangely enough, was not a Type 1. It was a Type 2, but that's another story.
Well, very good. All right, now, I think we should do this before we even start with the photos. And all of you can go to guests on the homepage and pull up Harry and look underneath his name and you'll see the photo gallery. Click on each one. They're thumbnails and they'll get to be full screen or nearly. Now, the number of German men who went to sea to serve in the U-boat Waffen. U-boat Waffe.
Yeah, the U-boat Waffe.
Was how many again? 30?
Roughly 35,000.
And how many came home?
5,000.
Just to give all of you an idea, and at the end of the war, they were lined up around the block trying to enlist in the U-boat service.
Yeah, the U-boat Waffe was the only oversubscribed force in the German military. They had people standing in line to get into the, even though they knew it was pretty risky, they didn't know the specifics, but from about Black May 1943 onward, normally 9 out of 10 U-boats were killed on their very first patrol. Never come home. And usually, like anybody...
9 out of 10, 90% casualty rate on their first patrol.
Yeah, after Black May of 43.
Yeah.
The advantage had swung over to the Allies. The Allies had huffed up. The minute the German radio man hit the key the first time, he was triangulated, and we had long-range bombers that were just waiting all over the ocean, and within 10, 15 minutes of a guy sending any radio message, they had bombers over them. Sonar was far advanced. Radar was far advanced. They had the 10-centimeter radar in airplanes. They could spot the U-boats from miles and miles away when they were flying. And the codes were broken by the Brits at Bletchley Park. So the Allies were reading the coded messages as fast as the Germans were.
How in the world was it that that Dönitz or whomever his predecessor might have been, why didn't they simply change the damn codes?
His predecessor was Erich Raeder, Erich Raeder. And Otto Kretschmer was a good friend of mine. And early on, when Dönitz was only a captain, Kapitän zur See, in command of the U-boats, Kretschmer was refusing to respond to the radio messages, you know, where are you? And they talked a lot on the air, which is what killed a lot of them. And when he got back, Dönitz called him aside and said, why didn't you answer my radio messages? You are duty-bound to obey orders, and I ordered you to answer. And Kretschmer says, my duty is to my submarine and my crew, and I knew they would find me if I started talking. And Dönitz said, okay, just don't tell the others. Peter Hansen, who's the only U-boat officer I know who's still alive, except for Captain Arndt, who's fairly quiet now, but Peter Hansen was in the U-boats, and he got shot up pretty bad in an air attack, so he couldn't ride on the boats anymore, so they put him into intel. And he said that anytime somebody would try to press Dönitz about the codes, Dönitz would be very angry with him. And according to Peter, the idea was if they did not believe it could happen, then it could not happen. I personally, just a dummy like myself, I would think they would send a coded message saying that on such and such a day, this U-boat was going to leave this port with Adolf Hitler on board, and see if that brought a bunch of bombers over. Then they would know. But the Enigma machine was supposed to be unbreakable. It was developed by the Polish before the war, and it was for to prevent industrial spying, stealing secrets from one another's country or company. And then it got into, and it got so advanced. They had a four-wheel rotor in there, four rotor wheels, and the combinations were in the billions. So nobody could figure that out, allegedly. Okay, well, they did figure it out. And that's a long story on how it was figured. And they did change the codes frequently. But it didn't matter if they changed the codes, because the mechanics behind how it worked were known. And so all they had to do was plug in the variables, and bingo, they had it done.
So, okay, is there a possibility of a mole at work?
Oh, I suppose anything's possible there. But when the Brits sank U-110, they didn't sink it, actually. Fritz Julius Lemp was the skipper. And they were getting beat up pretty badly by the Royal Navy. They came to the surface. He ordered everybody to abandon ship, and they opened the seacocks. And everybody got in the water, including a good friend of mine, Jörg Hugel, who was the radio operator. He was a radio operator on U-30. And then when the crew transferred over to U-110, he went with them. They were about 100 yards away from the submarine, just bobbing around in the water, waiting for the Brits to pick them up, and the submarine wasn't sinking. But because Lemp thought it was going to sink, they didn't bother to throw the Enigma rotors over the side. They left the code books in there and everything. And
I find that almost unbelievable. It happened. Stuff happens
it
in
happened.
War. I mean, it happens anywhere. But that's just incredible.
It was George Hugel's code books that the Allies got. Oops.
Wow.
And we'll cover that boat in today's session a little bit.
Okay.
This is only an overview, you understand, not an in-depth treatise.
Right.
And we're going to have a special offer for your listeners. So if your listeners, not right now, we won't do it now because nobody's ready. But if your listeners will go grab a paper and pencil, actually a pen, nobody uses pencil anymore, in a little while we'll give you a special offer on this book.
Are you actually going to deliver some of the books personally this time again? Is that what the special offer is?
No, that's not the special offer.
Oh.
Nice idea, however, it ain't the way it works.
Well, all right. Now, have you had any Entenmann's pastries lately?
No, my stabbing my finger in the morning and running the glucose.
Are you learning your lesson finally? Are you backing down a little bit?
Yeah, I'm trying to get it to where it doesn't peg the meter every morning.
All right. Well, we don't want that to happen, so.
No, I want to be around here for about another 28 and a half years. When I'm 110, then I can die.
You have plenty of work to do, for goodness sakes. All right, let's go to our picture gallery for tonight, put together by my wonderful webmaster, Norberto. Thank you. And he's such a great webmaster. First picture kind of tells the story.
Yeah, this was our guy, Greg Golinski, does all sorts of stuff like this, and the guy's a whiz. And this is kind of like a shopping mall layout that he's done for us, and it tells a story. Shark hunters is history, not hate.
Right. It's true.
Yep, and we're the only ones who, you know, you got these internet, Johnny-come-lately internet sites. None of them have ever met a U-boater, and yet all the top skippers, almost all the top skippers, were members of shark hunters, and tons of officers and enlisted men, dozens and dozens. And then we got the stories from them. And now Peter Hansen, of course, that guy is just an incredible fount of information.
Wow. Okay, excellent. Number two. It's a rare color photo taken from the front end, the bow end of a boat.
Yeah, I forget which
nice
boat
cover.
This was. It's not a rare color photo. Greg Golinski colorized a black and white for us.
Is that what that is?
Yep, that's a colorized black and white.
Dude, Greg did a good job.
Greg is a whiz with this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, very good. Okay. Number two. And now we'll go to number three. And we go
into the actual boats.
Yeah.
And like I say, the first couple boats were not the Type 1. The first bunch of boats were the Type 2. U-1 through 6 is the Type 2As, and then after that, 2Bs, etc. This was a Type 2A, 250-ton boat. 25-man crew, three torpedo tubes in the front. They would leave port with the three tubes loaded plus two more inside to reload, and that was it. The crews called them the Einbaumboote, which means the dugout canoes. And they used these mostly for training right after they got the production cranked up. And this is U-6. And you can see that they were pretty ornate. That big eagle and everything, that's a fixture attached to the conning tower, not painted.
Yeah.
So they were pretty ornate in the early days. Then they got a little
look
more.
Look at the conning tower on that. It's got actually almost has square sides to it. It's not streamlined. See that?
Yeah, this was one of the early ones. These Type 2s were built well before the war started.
And it looks like right above the third, the middle guy, see the three guys up there?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
See the middle one?
Yeah.
See the UFO over his head?
Yeah, I don't think that's a UFO, though. That's a picture.
Oh, come on, Harry.
Boat.
Don't ruin my fun.
I'm sorry. You see,
Damn.
The three guys all have white caps, which means they're all skippers. This boat was a training boat, so one of them was the actual skipper, and the other two would be skippers in training.
Got it.
Incidentally, the white cap was not issue, and you never saw Otto Kretschmer with a white cap. He was the top submarine commander of the whole war. Sank 48 ships. He was out of the war before the U.S. even got into it. He had sunk 48 ships. And I asked him, how come we never saw a picture of him with the white cap? And he said, well, he was a very straight-up Prussian officer. He said,
right.
It was not issue. It was not part of the uniform. So it was tradition, and they claim it so that the crew at night knew who the captain was by the white cap. Believe me, they knew who the captain was. He could have had a sheet over his head. They know who the captain was.
Sure.
But it was not issue, so Kretschmer didn't do it.
Interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, I wish Americans knew more about the character of the German military.
Yeah,
it's something that's a mystery, and it's been just so perverted and corrupted by the folks who write history. And they just paint these people out to be satanic monsters. And nothing could be further from the truth. It's just amazing.
Yeah, and when I try to tell the truth, I get people like the Sun and Poverty Law Center jumping on me.
Yeah, well, it's okay. It's a compliment. Picture number four, or the fourth picture.
Either one. Picture number four, which is U-6 again. These are all the instructors.
Yeah.
Yeah, waiting for a new crew to come aboard. And, they'd get all the rookies that have learned all about submarining in classrooms, and now they get on a submarine and they take it out. And unfortunately, they lost quite a few submarines in training.
They'd go out on combat patrols in training?
Only some of the, and very small numbers of them, and those would be on the bigger boats. This was a Type 2 training boat in the Baltic. But they only had a small area in which to operate, and sometimes they'd be doing training at 200, 300 feet down, and everything's running fine, and there's another submarine doing the same kind of training, and they wander up their little square, and they bash into each other, and one or both of them goes down with the whole crew.
Hmm.
Submarines generally take the whole crew with them when they go.
Was there much of an effort ever made to come up with a way to escape without, I guess, going through the torpedo tubes one at a time?
Yeah, they had something called a Draufganger. Oh, no, I'm sorry, that wrong term. What the hell was that thing? Anyhow, it was an
escape pod.
They had a rebreather.
Mm-hmm.
If the sub wasn't down too deep, they could get out. U-701 got sunk in 110 feet off our east coast, and about, I think, 17 people got off. Now, when the submarine goes down, that one got hit by a bomber, and it blew a huge hole in the stern of the sub, and it went down like a rock. And, of course, they didn't have a chance to get the watertight doors closed because the lookout didn't do his job, and the bomber got him before they could take any corrective measure. So this boat hit the bottom and filled up with water at the pressure of 110 feet down. And according to the skipper, Horst Degen, who was a member of Shark Hunters, there was only about a foot of air above the water in the boat, and it was extremely hot because when air is compressed, it gets hot. And so they put these It's called a Tauchretter. Tauchretter. A rebreather. It was a bag with a mouthpiece. And if you were not down too deep, you could get out. They were at 110 feet deep. And when the skipper undogged the hatch, he said he blew straight out of the boat from the pressure. And one by one, the guys came up and came out of the boat and floated to the surface, about 17 of them. But by the time they were done, only, I think, 7 or 8 were rescued, because it took the U.S. Navy 2 days to find them. They forgot about the Gulf Stream current. So it was possible. However, these guys were lucky. They got sunk in American waters, and the Allies really wanted to capture U-boat men as any time they could to squeeze information out of them. But most of the time, a submarine is operating in the wild blue yonder out there in the Mother Ocean. Mm-hmm. And even if you get out of the submarine, you're 2,000 miles from shore, bobbing around in a life jacket with no food, no water, no nothing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're not coming home.
No.
That's why they paid those guys extra money.
Wow. All right, next picture.
Number five. Oh,
now
yeah,
that's got a little ornamentation on the conning tower as well. I believe it's an iron cross.
Yeah, that was the emblem on their boat. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Each boat could pick their own emblems, and depending on the skipper and the crew, they would put on whatever they felt they liked. And that's what they had there, the Vulcan cross. And you'll notice they still got the running lights there.
Is that what to the left is?
Yeah, the big white mm-hmm. fixture just yeah. to the left of the cross.
Right.
They were very advanced for their time, but by today's standard, they were incredibly primitive.
Well, that's just to be expected. Okay, mm-hmm. number six.
Number six, U-10. I just put this in to show it was not all puppy dogs and ice cream, and it was not a luxury cruise. They're freezing their buns off there. And some of the boats, like, Eric Topp told us, he was a member of Shark Hunters, and I've been to his home I don't know how many times. He said when he was patrolling in the Arctic, the ice would build up so much on the boat up above, when it was surface, that he had to dive the boat every so often to melt the ice off. Otherwise, the boat would get top heavy.
Wow. Flip right over.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Where would that U-10 have been out on patrol to get that much ice?
This probably was not on patrol. That's a Type 2 again, so it would have been in the Baltic. But that's way north. It gets damn cold up there.
Yeah. Well, okay. Number seven.
Seven.
What's this pig with an umbrella?
Yeah, contrary to popular opinion, that is not my sister.
oh,
no, we're just showing some of the emblems. They were very creative. And, you can see the pig with the umbrella, and it appears like there's a couple of shells or some type of bombs coming down at it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that was
actually look like some kind of fixtures on the conning tower that they...
Okay.
They used the pig in an opportunistic way to use those two items. Now, there's the running light on the right. That one is at least painted dark.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, that would be the red light. Port side is always red. And the green is always starboard.
Okay.
And white is in the center.
How many U-boats survive today in museums or on display?
Oh, let's see. Damn few. In the United States, only one. That's U-505 in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
In England, there's U-534, which is the same kind of boat as U-505. They're both Type 9C, the long-range boats. But the one in England, a horror story on that thing. It was snake bit from the beginning. And finally, it's been cut into five sections. Let's see. In Germany, there are two U-995, the only Type 7 C left in the world. Germany built well over 800 of these things, and it's the only one left. And the
How many were cut up after the war? How many went down?
It depends. The ones that were scuttled by the Germans in various ports against Admiral Dönitz's orders, they were found, all except one. They were found, raised, and broken up. But the ones that surrendered to England, there were 300 or 400 of them. They hauled them out to deep water to the northwest of Ireland and either just opened the sea cocks and let them go down, or they used them for artillery targets. But they didn't all make it. We found out later they didn't all make it out to the deep water. Some of them, for instance, U-861, which was the boat of our member Jürgen Östen, it foundered and sank. They had to cut the tow line. It's in 100 feet of water. But it's in the North Atlantic. You don't want to scuba dive in the North Atlantic unless you really know what you're doing, because even on a calm day, it's nasty.
Now, that's a non-war grave. Is that boat worth bringing up?
You're right, it's a non-war grave. And it is legal to bring it up. However, you'd have to look at it to see what condition it's in. It's been in salt water since 1945.
Right. Okay. All right. Very
and
good.
We are looking at that now. One of our members, Ulrich Wiegand, is a German who emigrated to the United States. He's an American citizen. He and I are working together to see if we can find one that's in really good shape, that is not a war grave, and bring it. If it's in really good shape, bring it up, bring it over to the east coast of Florida, and start a museum to the Battle of the Atlantic.
Good job. All right, let's hope that works out someday.
Yeah.
Hold on a minute. We have to take a break. We'll be right back
that.
With Admiral Harry Cooper coming up next.